Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel, and we have Brian Curtis, who's editor-at-large and sports media columnist at The Ringer, joining us. Brian published a story today examining the legacy of what Jamie Horowitz leaves behind at FS1. At this point, there's not enough information that has come out of Fox's sexual harassment probe that led to Jamie's exit from the network for us to feel comfortable speaking about that part of the story extemporaneously. SI's Richard Deitch published some allegations from an unnamed producer that, if true, it goes without saying, are problematic. We're not privy to whether more allegations will emerge, nor what they may entail. The sides' respective legal representations are digging in for what could be a prolonged legal battle. And in personal disclosure, my boss, Jason McIntyre, is an on-air talent at FS1 who, like virtually everybody there, was hired by Jamie Horowitz. Brian, one of the reasons that we constantly refresh Twitter is that sometimes the slot machine pulls up an absolute bombshell, like John Oren's tweet at 1:07 p.m. on Monday that Jamie Horowitz would be out of Fox Sports effective immediately. Your reaction when you saw that tweet was blank.
Disbelief, total shock. In our little corner of the universe, which is an admittedly small corner of the universe that you and I inhabit, it's an amazing, just shocking piece of news. I don't know how else to say it like that. I couldn't believe my eyes.
The last time I felt this type of shock from seeing a tweet come out regarding sports media was when Richard Sandomir tweeted that Bill Simmons, who was your boss at the time and is again now, was out at ESPN. Now, if you could somehow remove the personal aspect of that, which is impossible, would you agree that this is the most shocking thing that we've seen come out of almost seemingly nowhere since then?
Yeah, I guess it's very difficult for me, as you say, to remove the personal part from that other piece of news. But yeah, this is that level of story, and in this case, you know, wasn't preceded by, at least in my view, any kind of lead up to it. It was just completely out of nowhere for most of us, I think.
Right, because it just felt that he had a very big mandate. You mentioned in the story that you wrote all of the layoffs and the pivot to video in the digital realm. It seemed like he was remaking the whole, not just television network, but PR department, which then got like really armed against him yesterday, and the digital, and everybody. There was one person who described it as Horowitz was building a fiefdom, and really it was just taken away all in apparently a week or less.
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest questions I always got in sports TV circles and from sports TV people, including at least one inside the mothership of Fox, which was, how much rope does Horowitz have? How much time does he have to execute this vision? We all know what the ratings were for those shows, and a lot of people kept asking, well, is this going to have time? Is something going to happen? And all, again, until yesterday, all signs to me were that he had a lot of time. And that it wasn't something, you know, again, just in terms, we're just talking purely in television terms now, that he was executing his vision. And if you ever talk to Horowitz, he would absolutely tell you that he was full of confidence, that things were going his way, that he felt optimistic about the future. So it was, but again, it was something that a lot of people in television sort of wondered, how much time does this guy have to execute this? That again, until yesterday, it seemed like he had quite a lot.
Yeah, you mentioned the ratings. In a Horowitz debate fashion, I want to challenge something that you wrote, which, and what you just said, was that you implied that the ratings were low. Now, by ESPN standards or by children's television rerun standards, there were certainly not a lot of viewers. But in Skip Bayless, who you've written, you profiled him, and you wrote in this piece that you've studied him very closely for a quarter century now, I would say that he almost on his own, the partnership of Horowitz and Bayless, siphoned about 100,000 viewers on average per day from the ESPN-ESPN2 universe, which is around, I don't know, 10, 15, some days 20% of what their audience would have been in 2014, 2015, before these moves transpired. Is there anybody other than Skip and Colin and maybe Stephen A that Jamie could have plugged in on this upstart network and gotten more viewers?
No, and I think that's important context for this, right? I mean, I am not a fan of TV ratings, the use and abuse of TV ratings that the way we use them, because a lot of times we're taking whatever it is we already believe and finding a rating point to further that argument. And again, they're very complex kinds of things. And sure, and you can totally argue that FS1 was literally starting from the bottom, and that, you know, he was buying a bunch of people. They were very expensive contracts in a lot of cases. You mentioned Bayless, you mentioned Coward, and was trying to make traction. And then, in fact, he was, you know, again, if you listen to Fox, he was getting a lot of traction, particularly against ESPN2, and was beginning to, you know, sort of, that was going to be the first, that was his first, that was the first goal in his eyes, was to start beating ESPN2 up and down the schedule. And then he would, you know, hopefully, again, if everything went right, he would have a chance to focus on the mothership. So, yeah, I mean, I just think in terms of, you know, to have that big rating success, and again, I don't even know how much it's worth judging given how short a time he was there and how little time he had to carry all this out, whether that's even worth saying. And what I was just trying to point out is he didn't have a chance to put it, and he certainly, as Scott Van Pelt pointed out a couple of times and other people at ESPN, he talked a lot about ESPN's ratings. So you're right, he had a certainly success in lowering them in a lot of cases, but maybe not the chance to put the giant number on the board that he wanted to.
Yeah, and now, so the Nick Wright Chris Carter show that's at least until the events this week was scheduled to launch in time for football season this year, that was supposed to provide a lead in for Undisputed, and I presume that things aren't going to change so quick that it won't, but with all this, really, who knows? I do wonder, though, what the ceiling could have been once he did have all these building blocks in place, how much an appetite there would have been for wall-to-wall programming like this. And I guess we're not going to get to see how that vision plays out now.
Maybe not. But I also think probably the most likely thing that's going to happen is this was all what they've started will, with few exceptions, probably just continue apace. I mean, they are so deeply invested in these guys. They have spent so much time and so much money on all these guys. You know, it would seem quite odd at this point to just turn around and abandon that. Now, maybe, you know, the vision of those shows changes around the margins. But the other big thing about FS1 is, you know, well, you know, Big Ten football starts this fall. And all of a sudden, there's a lot more to watch on that network. How many times, and I'd say this to you as a Midwesterner, how awful is it to turn on ESPN every Saturday and freaking Michigan is on to that noon game, and you can never get rid of it? It could be Michigan playing anybody. All of a sudden, FS1 is starting to get some of that programming and make, you know, the channel a little bit more well-rounded. So I don't know. To me, there's a very plausible scenario where Eric Shanks temporarily takes it over and says, okay, we're going to go with this, maybe in slightly different form, but we're going to go with the building blocks that have already been put in place.
Now, there are three things that I read that I'm going to cite now that make me wonder if they might be considering at this point, depending on who ends up taking over the network for the long term, pivoting from that. So in the Wall Street Journal, Joe Flint wrote the sentence, at Fox Sports, Mr. Horowitz was tasked with boosting the performance of its cable network, FS1, which was launched in August 2013 to take on ESPN. The network has struggled to develop signature programming that will keep viewers tuned in when there isn't a sports event on. Now, that goes back to the ratings context that we talked about earlier, but this is somebody from within 21st Century Fox downplaying the success of what they built. And then Anthony Krupe, who writes for Ad Age, and he broke the story on the Carter Wright Show, and he broke the story on Fox's We Want to Own the Fall pitch at advertising upfronts. He wrote something very similar, saying that while Horowitz's embraced debate strategy certainly kept the sports media world aflutter, FS1 studio shows aren't exactly robbing ESPN executives of sleep. And then he went and talked about some number of ratings. And then this is the most ominous. Michael McCarthy at Sporting News, who's had his finger on the pulse of Fox's decision-making for a year or so now, he's been breaking a lot of their stories. He said that he worries that Skip Bayless might not be safe and that Skip might be wanting to worry about his beach house in Malibu. Can you fathom like a world where this time next year Skip is no longer on FS1?
It would be almost equally shocking as Horowitz not running FS1 to me. And I think, you know, the question of all this is if you go away from this stuff, let's acknowledge that this is all built around Horowitz's very particular vision of sports television, right?
Right.
What do you do? What else do you do? We saw one version of FS1. It didn't work at all. Now we've seen this version. We've seen ESPN, you know, really trying to solve this problem of how do we get people to watch TV when it's not, as you say, a giant sporting event on television. I don't know. And I think, you know, it's one thing to say, let's change course. It's another thing to say, what are we going to change course to? We're going to run news programming. We're going to run our version of SportsCenter. After, you know, Horowitz's one argument over and over again was that SportsCenter, that highlight-driven shows are dead. I don't know. And maybe there's a creative answer to that question, but I'm not sure what it would be.
Well, the dark answer from someone like you or me who likes a marketplace for talent and likes a marketplace of ideas where we can flip to different channels and find different things that we like and not be totally beholden on ESPN. And as somebody who I'm rooting for Jason to succeed as an on-air television talent, what if they just punt on studio programming? They use FS1 to run baseball games, Big Ten, UFC, and they use it as a mechanism to get that cable subscriber fee, which I think that a big portion of what they charge the cable companies for affiliates is from their live rights and not from the fact that they have Skip Bayless and Colin Cowherd. What if they just say, we're just going to show these games and we're going to punt on trying to fill this channel the rest of the week?
So it becomes like NBCSN, except with much better games, something like that. Or
right. Well,
or ESPN2 without even the minor talk inventory that ESPN2 has.
Yeah, it would be, I don't know, that's the doomsday scenario, and that's what I'm concerned about as an admittedly biased observer right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's, you know, but look, you know, that's the kind of existential question I think you have to ask yourself right now, right? I mean, with all studio shows, and with everything in sports television, and with what we just saw happen at ESPN, that's not out of the question. I'm not saying I think that's going to happen, but it's not out of the question. Like I said, to me, and McCarthy and those guys may, you know, be sort of, you know, feeling what the winds are right now and be onto something, and I wouldn't doubt that they are, but I just think, to me, the easiest thing would be to just stay the course. And whether you have every single hour is exactly the same, but if you just sort of say, you know, now maybe somebody new won't have the appetite as much as Horowitz did for everything that Skip Bayless wants to say, right? Skip said one of the biggest things he said upon going to FS1 is, I'm going to be able to say more things here. I'm not going to have to watch my back like I did at ESPN. Now, will the next person, Shanks or whoever the takes over the network, have the same appetite that Horowitz did for that kind of controversial stuff? Probably not. Maybe not. So maybe you'd see some sort of changes there. But yeah, I mean, that's why I would say almost. You almost just roll everything back out and let it keep going.
I would say that from taking the temperature, Colin is the stalwart because I think in the last couple years, now he still has like the anti-John Wall thing that's very bizarre, but that's he's never going to come around on John Wall, but he's. He's the one FS1 talent who crossed over onto Big Fox on the NFL pregame show. And I think by virtue of that and the fact that his show is successful in multiple mediums, I think that he's insulated from any of these real or perceived winds of change.
Maybe so. I mean, he is their chief, and I say this as a compliment, he's their chief innings leader over there, right? He's just on all the time. And, you know, that's in a way, in a weird way, in our new world, that's how you earn your spurs, right? You're on all the time. You're useful.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. So one of the thing that got the green highlight in your piece, for people who don't read Medium or The Ringer a lot, the green highlight is, I think, reader generated of like what they think the best line is. You wrote, and though Horowitz has promoted Skip, Shannon, Colin, etc., why was a woman never given the same keys to the kingdom? Now, I think that's true at FS1. There certainly aren't any women who are leading the debate shows, but in terms of like keys to the kingdom, I feel like Michelle Beadle got that at Sports Nation, and Carissa Thompson, she's not a huge debater or anything, but her career started under Jamie, and I think she's reached a pretty enviable level of success now. Did you just mean at FS1, or did you mean in total?
Yeah, and I meant at FS1, probably should have been clear about that. You could also probably add Jamel Hill to that list, certainly somebody that was promoted under Horowitz and flourished under Horowitz. On Numbers Never Lie / His and Hers. But yeah, I mainly meant at FS1.
And then also, like, the part in your piece about kind of, do we want to appeal to sports media critics or do we want to appeal to Trump voters? Horowitz did some higher-brow shows at ESPN that didn't have the same type of commercial success. Sports Nation got a lot of positive press, but when he was running that show, it didn't have like the amount of viewers as a First Take or something of that nature. And then there was, as you mentioned, Numbers Never Lie / His and Hers. And he also ran that Keith Olbermann show. I think that at FS1, he made a conscious decision, I'm going to be a capitalist and I'm going to apply my talents to where I think I can maximize viewership. And that just happened to be with the Skip Bayless show and the Colin show. Do you agree with that or no?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can take FS1 and say, this is pure Horowitz. You know, this was his chance to sort of enact his vision. And this is what we have. And you're right, you know, his sort of total work product is not just that. It's not just the First Take undisputed model. But I think given the chance to basically program a network from top to bottom, which he did, that's what he went with. And so I think that's, you know, at the end of the day, and again, I think I was just talking about Skip Bayless in that line you just cited specifically,
yeah.
Not just everything he did in his life, but and by the way, ESPN's view of Skip Bayless, not Horowitz's, but
right.
You know, that's what he came up with, and I think that's, you know, at the end of the day, probably what the, you know, the at least what we have to judge in front of us in terms of his TV work.
Now, I'm not privy to what Colin or Skip's contracts say. But let's say hypothetically there is a clause in their contract that allows them to leave given that Jamie's gone now. Do you think that ESPN would welcome both of them back as a way of just like, A, filling some gaps that happened when they left, and B, totally toppling FS1 as a formidable studio competitor for really ever if they did that?
It's like a wrestling storyline, isn't it? Those guys going back. we don't even need the wrestling analogy. It just feels like the NBA free agency that's going on right now. You know, I don't know. That's a fascinating question, what the appetite would be within those places. You probably know this better than me, but I have not seen either of those guys really go out of their way to torch ESPN from afar. You know, Bayless has, as I said, talked about the limitations he thought he was under there because they were a Disney company. Coward said something about the layoffs the other day that I thought was actually fairly anodyne, though Dan Le Batard got mad about it. But you know,
Stu Gotts got mad about it.
I just don't think, you know, so I haven't seen, you know, there hasn't been like a giant war like the one that Horowitz himself was a part of with ESPN. It's kind of hard to imagine given the way that ESPN has moved on that, you know, it's like, what do you do with those guys? But that's a fascinating question.
Colin has pejoratively referred to ESPN kind of as like a subtweet as he starts sentences, my former employer, and then he launches into what is a criticism of ESPN, but it's certainly nothing along the lines of like things that Woj has said over the years or Olbermann returned. Totally. I don't think that he has like napalmed his bridges, to use Olbermann's word.
Yeah, the famous Olbermann word. And I think in a way, you know, it's like criticizing ESPN is now just something that ESPN sort of like the New York Times. You know, at one point, maybe that was a career ender. You know, if outside the walls, you were criticizing ESPN really harshly and publicly. And I think now it's just kind of realized that that's what comes with being the leader in the industry. And you take it. And if it's somebody you want to work with, you move on.
One thing we both did not like about what Jamie did was the way that he got rid of all editorial in one fell swoop and pivoted to video. We didn't get to see any real sample of how this was going to manifest itself. It was pretty clear that they were doing this as a mechanism in which they believed that web traffic is totally obsolete, because their homepage was completely worthless. And I think even the biggest supporter of what they were trying to do would have acknowledged that, okay, we don't view the homepage as any sort of priority or something that we want to capitalize on. But I agreed with you that they could have used digital as a building block to find new talent, because eventually they're going to run out of people who are leaving ESPN. And like there wasn't anybody that Jamie inherited at Fox, Katie Nolan included, that he was able to work together with in a productive media working relationship.
Yeah, I just thought when you looked at the, I'm not somebody who read that website a ton, but when I did, it didn't strike me that the product on the website was all that different than a lot of the product on the TV. And I don't say that to insult either side. It just seemed like the kind of takes that were on the website on a daily basis that were flying out of there were kind of like the takes on TV. And a lot of those could have made a great segment on any of those FS1 shows, you know? Okay, let's talk about what, you know, there were Colin Kaepernick takes all over that site, to my memory. And so I didn't get that. I didn't understand it. I know he has been, you know, wherever he's gone in FS1, certainly most notably, he's been about cleaning house, bringing in his people, executing his vision from top to bottom. But I didn't understand really what those, you know, really handful of people at FS1. Maybe it was just a headcount thing and that somehow played into it. But I just didn't think the idea of aggregating yet more takes from the people who are already on TV at FS1 was a strategy, certainly something I wanted to read, and it didn't sound like something that would be successful either.
Well, the strategy is optimizing views within social media platforms. Now, Facebook just gives astronomical viewpoints. If you go and look at FS1 or Fox Sports Facebook and scroll through and look at the nominal video counts of how many people are allegedly watching these things, they're quite high. And then you add in the YouTube views are really high on everything Colin or Undisputed puts out. And then I don't know how you measure on Twitter, but I assume they were getting what they felt was good engagement there. They were just punting on the web page as an entity of which to reach people. But I don't think that the video stats that they believe they have are as formidable as you would if you just took the raw number. There isn't a standard metric for what constitutes a real video view. And it's weird that advertisers are just pouring their money into that, knowing that the metrics aren't standardized. But I think that that's what their strategy was. I just don't think it was a good long-term thing, because we saw Facebook could topple sites. Like, Upworthy thought they were doing what Facebook wanted, and then all of a sudden their traffic got cut off by like 80% and now they're dead. And so I think that Fox was like going down a precarious path with that role. But I agree with you that their website shouldn't have cost them too much to continue like at least a bare bones outfit that has some original written editorial content.
Not to mention the bizarre kind of situation where, you know, the network says, we want Bruce Feldman as a sideline reporter, but we don't want Bruce Feldman as a writer and a podcaster. That's just weird.
How could you not want like Bruce Feldman or Stuart Mandel or Ken Rosenthal like writing for you and breaking news? They don't care about news gathering, but that was a curious decision to me, because if you have proprietary information, you should be able to make money on it, and they know things before anybody else on the planet does.
Yeah, it doesn't even mean when you say news gathering, it doesn't mean you have to have people writing gamers of every Warriors game. It just means like, okay, we're just going to have, you know, Ken Rosenthal's notes column. And we're going to have Feldman's notes column. We're going to have Feldman's podcast. I just think you can kind of pick your spots and you don't have to cover the whole world. And I hear your point about video and everything, but it just seems like you could do both. You know, you could throw those column videos all over the place and still have people just writing off the news of the day. I don't get it.
I know you have a hard out. Anything else interesting with the FS1 developments within the confines of programming decisions that we didn't touch on?
Well, I just think, you know, more broadly about Horowitz, I think when you look around television, you mentioned some of the ESPN stuff, you know, you just see a lot of his fingerprints all over, not just FS1, but both ESPN and FS1. We mentioned the shows that he worked on, the people he worked with at ESPN. And even if you look at the new ESPN lineup, I don't think, you know, they would, of course, hotly dispute that they were working in the Horowitz model. They would also hotly dispute that those shows were debate, right? You keep hearing the other D word from ESPN talent these days, discussion, right? We're not debate, we're discussion. But his critique that highlights were no longer enough to carry a show, and that shows would rise and fall based on the personality of the host and the relationship between the hosts, things that he worked on, you know, that was his aesthetic, that is up and down the ESPN dial now when you look at their new lineup. You know, whether it's Pablo and Bomani, whether it's Lebatard, whether it's SC6, whether it's First Take, it may be in a very different, slightly different way than Horowitz did and would have done. They may have their own, ESPN has their own spin on it. It's unique to ESPN. I'm not doubting and disputing any of that. But certainly, you know, the world that he sort of helped usher in is now pretty widespread in sports television.
Thanks so much, Brian. Appreciate it. Hope to have you on again in the coming months. Once again, Brian Curtis, editor-at-large, sports columnist at The Ringer. He has a great piece on Jamie Horowitz's legacy and what he built at FS1. Go read it and have a great rest of the 4th of July.
Happy 4th, Ryan. Thanks much, man.
Bye, Brian.
don't notice you. Familiar touch turns stranger. Will you notice if I don't notice you? Familiar touch turns stranger.